From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today we look at the fallen Associate Attorney General, Webster Hubbell, and White House efforts to keep him in the money. Were they trying to keep him out of the way? Then a discussion on national tests. Will they increase standards or dumb down American students? And what do nuclear proliferation in space, the PR industry's war on activists, and Shell Oil have in common? They're all among the top 10 censored stories of 1996. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A lone juror in Spokane, Washington, spared three white separatists from being convicted on charges they carried out a string of bank robberies and bombings in the name of Yahweh. I would say they should retry it, jury foreman Alan Eisenbacher told the Associated Press after the verdict yesterday. I'm disappointed we couldn't come to a decision one way or the other. After 4 days of deliberations, the jury was unable to reach a verdict yesterday on charges related to the bombing of Planned Parenthood and the Spokesman Review newspaper and the robbery and bombing of a U.S. bank. The jury convicted the men of conspiracy, transport of stolen vehicles, and possession of hand grenades in connection with what prosecutors said was a failed attempt to rob a Portland, Oregon bank. Less than 2 days after attempting suicide, a man in Texas who killed a woman while robbing a topless nightclub was put to death by lethal injection. David Lee Herman tried to slash his throat and wrist with a plastic razor on Tuesday. He spent 3 hours in a hospital getting his wound stitched, and then he was executed. The state of Florida will use its electric chair to execute two more condemned inmates despite last month's incident with Pedro Medina. There have been suggestions that Florida should switch to lethal injection after Pedro Medina's face mask caught on fire during the electrocution. Florida lawmakers say they will not switch the method. Some said they were happy with what happened because they said it will act as a deterrent. And an anti-abortion activist in Bozeman, Montana, was arrested and charged with arson early yesterday in a fire that burned the roof of a building that houses a women's health clinic. Police said they caught John Yankowski on the roof of the three-story building and arrested him. The Mountain Country Women's Clinic opened for business later in the morning. Just after the Civil War, the 15th Amendment to the United States Constitution guaranteed that no one could be denied the right to vote because of their race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Only 127 years later, Tennessee has become the last state to formally agree. The state's House of Representatives and the Senate voted unanimously yesterday to make amends, unanimously approving a resolution that ceremoniously ratified what has been the law of the land since 1870. Meanwhile, the Census Bureau is considering whether to count people of mixed race as a separate category. Supporters say the move would help foster a sense of pride and self-affirmation among the swelling ranks of mixed race Americans. But some civil rights advocates worry the new category would reduce the numbers of blacks and Hispanics recorded in the census that could imperil minority voting districts and financing for minority aid programs. This news from Hollywood. Decades after blacklisted Hollywood screenwriters were forced to hide behind pseudonyms, the Writers Guild of America has voted to correct the credits for 24 more McCarthy-era films. Among the 40s to 70s movies affected by Monday night's vote are Born Free, Hellcats of the Navy, Inherit the Wind, and The Robe. The case against the Saudi suspect in last year's deadly bombing at the U.S. military barracks in Saudi Arabia that we discussed yesterday on Democracy Now! May be too weak to extradite him from Canada. This, according to the New York Times today. The administration is even uncertain whether the man, Hani Abdelrahim Al-Sayah, can provide enough evidence to make it worthwhile to bring him to the United States. This, according to the Times, quoting senior officials it did not identify. The bombing killed 19 Americans. And Israel Israel is saying today it's suspending its request for the United States to hand over a leader of the militant movement Hamas. Security sources said Israel feared the extradition of Musa Mohammed Abu Marzouk would spark a wave of attacks in Israel. Israel did not contend that Abu Marzouk personally committed any of the violent acts, but charged he was criminally liable because of his high-level role in allegedly directing, controlling, and financially supporting Hamas's activities. Abu Marzouk has denied involvement in any violence. Ousted Indonesian minority party leader Megawati Sukarno-Putri, blocked by the dictator Suharto from contesting the country's May 29th election, now has a homepage on the Internet's World Wide Web. Creators of the Indonesian language Meraputi Online, which is Meraputi, MERAHPUTIH.com, which opened this week, said the page will be updated with a weekly interview and twice-weekly Megawati editorials and other articles. About 100 students backing Megawati demonstrated in front of the parliament today in Jakarta to call for a boycott of the May 29th elections. Megawati is the daughter of Indonesian founding president Sukarno. Members of another party, the left-wing People's Democratic Party, PRD, which is not officially recognized, has started a graffiti campaign calling for a boycott. Leaders of the group, most of them students, are on trial for subversion, which carries a maximum penalty of death. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Alongside the campaign finance and Whitewater scandals lies yet another political time bomb that could also spell serious trouble for the White House, the case of the former Assistant Attorney General and Clinton confidant Webster Hubble. An Arkansas friend of the Clintons and a law partner of Hillary Rodham Clinton at the Rose Law Firm, Webster Hubble resigned from his Justice Department post in 1994 after being charged with the fraudulent billing of his clients. He pleaded guilty to the charge and was sent to jail in 1995. He has served 18 months and has just come out and living in a halfway house in Washington, not to be confused with the White House. But just before he was indicted, Webster Hubble was hired by the Lippo Group, an Indonesian conglomerate with close ties to the Indonesian dictator Suharto. And yesterday, two senior White House officials conceded they had tried to find work for Hubble after he resigned. The implication is that the White House sought lucrative work for Hubble in order to keep him from talking to independent counsel Kenneth Starr, but that has yet to be proven. Here to discuss the significance of the case and the latest revelations is Glenn Simpson, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal who's been covering the case of Webster Hubble. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Glenn.
Thanks a lot.
Well, why don't we start the way you started your piece in The Wall Street Journal yesterday, telling the story of a March 94 meeting with President Clinton, Hillary Rodham Clinton, and a group of White House advisors.
Right. So they're meeting to discuss that their White House counsel, Bernard Nussbaum, has decided to resign amid questions about his conduct following the suicide of Vince Foster and various other matters. And they've got a bunch of other Whitewater developments which are embarrassing and damaging, and they sit and talk about these. Then they talk about yet another big problem, which is that the Associate Attorney General Webster Hubble is going to have to resign because of a billing dispute with his partners at the Rose Law Firm. And as the meeting is breaking up, Mac McClarty, a longtime Arkansas hand, says to Mrs. Clinton, I'll be helping out Webb. You can read that a lot of different ways. The most innocent way is that it was an expression of condolence to Mrs. Clinton regarding one of her longtime friends.
How do you know about this?
The White House came clean and basically put it out yesterday. But, it's sort of been filtering out in bits and pieces from various participants for months now.
Can you explain what the problem is with Mac McClarty, with Erskine Bowles, the current chief of staff, with even the First Lady herself, Hillary Rodham Clinton, trying to get money to Webster Hubble?
Well, the problem, if you believe the White House, is merely one of perception. The perception potentially being that some people think Webster Hubble knows information, that the White House has things to hide, and that they were trying to encourage him not to share this information with independent counsel Kenneth Starr. That's, you know, what potentially the problem is. That's what Starr is trying to figure out.
Now, they're insisting that it is not hush money, that they were simply trying to help out a friend. But it seems that part of the problem with believing this, aside from, you know, sort of its obvious look, is how much the White House has refused to reveal until now and is now slowly putting out information when forced by reporters like you who keep asking these questions.
Right. I mean, that's definitely part of the problem. If this is as innocent as it's being made out to be, why is it coming out? You know, why is it like pulling teeth to get the full story here? You know, I mean, this story is definitely not over yet either. I mean, there's more shoes to drop probably. On the other hand, this is sort of the way the White House operates, and you know, it might be going too far to read an enormous amount into it. You know, we just honestly don't know. I mean, you know, the Clinton White House is not in the habit of disclosing anything that they don't have to disclose. And, you know, that is sort of just their attitude. It may not be more nefarious than that.
Can you explain how difficult it has been or what has been the sort of chronology of what the White House has admitted, including the White House press conferences where President Clinton is very, I guess you could say, cagey or careful about what he says?
Right. Well, you can't accuse the president right now of having told an untruth. What you can say is that he has been incredibly parsimonious in you know, his commentary when asked about this subject. The best example was at a recent press conference, a reporter asked him, "Mr. President, what did you know about the job that Webster Hubbell received from the Lippo Group?" And he said, "Well, I knew nothing about that in advance. The only thing I only knew about it when I read about it in the newspaper. Whoever did that, boy, they shouldn't have done that. That was a bad idea." He knew at that time that, in fact, you know, some of his other friends had given Webb Hubbell jobs, and he didn't say, "Oh, and by the way, I did, however, know that two of my old buddies from Arkansas days did give Webb Hubbell jobs in 1994, and I knew all about it at that time." So, you know, it sort of begs the question, well, you know, how could you go on at length about the Lippo job without, you know, bringing up these other jobs that you did know about?
Well, let's talk about the money that Webster Hubbell got, the $485,000 at least that has been documented to this point between the time when he was basically forced to leave the Justice Department and when he was indicted. Let's talk about the companies, starting with the Lippo Bank and the Riotti sum of, what was it, $100,000 that they gave him. What did he do for this?
Well, first of all, we don't know the exact sum. It could be larger. It probably is not any smaller. Second of all, we don't know what he did. He's claiming that that's attorney-client confidential, refusing to answer that question. Presumably, eventually, Ken Starr will get to the bottom of that, but we reporters certainly have very little ability to get inside something that's as closely held as that.
What about some of the other groups? You go into, for example, Mr. Rappaport, a longtime Clinton financial backer, staying overnight at the White House a few days after Hubbell's exit from the Justice Department, and then Rappaport's company, American Income Life Insurance, giving Hubbell $18,000 for unspecified work.
Right. It's basically like a $3,000 a month retainer. He tells me, Mr. Rappaport tells me that Hubbell did some legal work of unspecified nature, as well as some consulting. Now, his company, Mr. Rappaport's company, makes its money marketing insurance policies to union members. And it is possible that Mr. Hubbell may have made some introductions along those lines, although various people in that business say they don't know of anything that he did like that.
what is the amount of time that we're talking about here that Webster Hubbell got this money between the time he left the Justice Department and the time he was indicted? How much money, how much time was it?
Well, it's basically about 8 months. But the interesting thing is that a lot of it came in a big splash only a couple of months after he left the Justice Department. It was an extraordinary amount of success for somebody who had just resigned under cloudy circumstances. It came pouring in very quickly. As I said before, the full story of this is not known. It may not be hush money per se, but clearly there was an orchestrated effort to get him a lot of money, not just enough money to tide him over in bad times. Just why is still a mystery.
So what does Erskine Bowles say about that? He says when he was head of the Small Business Administration, he made some calls. He tried to get him money, but it was to help a friend. But we're talking about $500,000. What does he say?
Well, that's right. He says it's to help a friend. Everybody seems to say, well, how dare you think that, I wouldn't go out of my way to help someone who was hurting. I'm a nice guy, blah, blah, blah. Mr. Bowles' problem is that he's not an old friend of Webster Hubbell's. I mean, as far as I know, they never met before 1992 during the Clinton campaign. Bowles, unlike pretty much everybody else at the White House, doesn't go back a real long ways with Clinton. So that explanation is considerably weaker in his case.
So what is Bowles then? How is Bowles explaining himself? And what do you think this means for his tenure as chief of staff? Does it in any way imperil that?
There was a lot of speculation about that when the news came out. But it doesn't appear right now as if it's a big problem for him. One of the things that's in the papers today is that one of the companies that Bowles went to try and get Hubbell his job is a small business investment corporation, which means it's heavily regulated by the SBA, the Small Business Administration. And at the time that this was going on, Bowles was the head of the SBA. So there's an ethical issue there, potentially. Now, Hubbell didn't get the job, so it's not as bad as it could be. But it appears at the moment that, Mr. Bowles' job is safe, and the White House tells me that he has absolutely no intention of stepping aside or anything like that.
Well, President Clinton is not exactly famous for standing behind people when they're going down, unless it's Dick Morris.
Right. If he got in deep trouble, I think that would happen, but it just doesn't seem on the horizon right now.
Can you quickly go through the other companies, groups and individuals that paid Webster Hubbell that close to $500,000? You have a little chart in the Wall Street Journal yesterday that goes through them, the Mid-America Dairymen's Association, Time Warner, Lipo Group, and others.
Right. Yeah, there's about 10. And they're varied. Sprint, Pacific Tel. They all, in one way or another, have a connection to Clinton or his friends. They're clients of a particular lobbyist who's friendly with the White House, that sort of thing. One of them is a fund set up by a California trial attorney. Most of them, several of them are companies that have distinct lobbying interests in Washington. Although you don't get the impression that they were doing this, in an effort to win any particular favor from the president. But, it's like Time Warner, things like that, companies that certainly would want to be in the president's good graces.
Now, Glenn Simpson, we only have a minute, but you have also an interesting piece in today's Wall Street Journal on Harold Ickes documenting his documents, raising fresh questions about origins of some DNC donations.
Right. It turns out, and this is not the first time that this sort of thing has happened, it turns out that a Taiwanese businessman gets in to see Clinton and the documents say the Taiwanese businessman is supposed to give $100,000 in exchange for this meeting with Clinton. Well, you know, obviously it's troubling enough that anyone would pay $100,000 to see the president. But what's more troubling in this case is, of course, the guy's Taiwanese. He's not legally eligible to contribute. Well, the federal records don't say that he contributed. What they do say is that his good friend Charlie Tree, whose name is coming up a lot in this whole matter, gave the day after this White House meeting. So it's clear that, Tree gave on behalf of this fellow. The question we don't know is, where did Charlie Tree get his money from?
And we should also say that Winston Wang, who was the one who met with the president, is the son of Taiwan's most influential businessman, Y.C. Wang, founder of Formosa Plastics.
Right.
Well, we'll continue to follow the story. I want to thank you for doing that. Glenn Simpson, staff reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Democracy Now! And if your cup is running over with this information on campaign finances, we want to remind you that we are still making our offer available to you, our Mug with a Message campaign, and that is the issue of who gets to meet with President Clinton at those White House coffees. And if you'd like an invitation to the White House, we have a suggestion about how you can do it. We have mugs made. On one side, they say Democracy Now! On the other side, they say, Dear President Clinton, coffee, tea, and me. And the idea is that we know he meets with arms exporters and bankers and corporate executives. What about the rest of us? If you'd like to have a copy of that mug sent to the White House with a personal letter from you and a request for an invitation for that coffee, you can call us at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can also get one of those Democracy Now! Mugs for yourself if you'd like. When we come back, we're going to take a look at an issue that President Clinton raised yesterday, and that is pushing standardized tests for fourth and eighth graders. What are standardized tests? How will they affect education in America? And then we'll look at the top 10 censored stories of 1996. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In a State of the Union message in January, President Clinton made clear that educational reforms would be a cornerstone of his second term in office. At the heart of President Clinton's push to raise standards is a national testing initiative, which, simply put, is a plan to give tests to all fourth and eighth graders. Yesterday at the White House, President Clinton held a roundtable with educators and corporate executives where he announced that California had become the fourth state to support the tests. Clinton also collected the endorsement of some 240 high-tech business executives for his plan to administer reading tests to all fourth graders and math tests for all eighth graders. Joining us right now to talk about President Clinton's education proposals is Monty Neal, Associate Director of the National Center for Fair and Open Testing, called Fair Test, as the group is known, a testing reform advocacy group based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Monty.
Hello.
Well, it seems innocent enough, a test for fourth and eighth graders to increase education standards in this country.
Well, the trick of the question is whether or not the tests will, in fact, increase contribute to increasing student learning, or whether they will be irrelevant or whether they will actually be harmful. We believe the real story here is that these tests, unfortunately, will be more harmful than helpful.
In what way?
Well, what Clinton has called for is the use of tests that will be, according to the Education Department, 80% multiple choice. They're going to cost, he says, $5 a piece to administer and score, which means that they'll be lucky if they're not more than 80% multiple choice, because that's an extremely low price. If they're not multiple choice, they usually have to be scored by actual human beings rather than by machines, and that's simply a lot more expensive. Now, the problem of the story is that multiple choice items cannot be used well to measure student learning except in very narrow ways. That is, if you want to know if a student can recognize that 2 plus 2 has an answer of 4, multiple choice is pretty reasonable. But if you want to know if the student can take his or her mathematical knowledge and solve a real-world problem, multiple choice usually is not a very useful method for measurement. With a mostly multiple choice test, what's going to happen is the emphasis will be on recognizing correct answers and memorizing facts and rules and procedures. There is nothing wrong with some memorization. The problem comes when memorization dominates the whole curriculum. We know from a lot of research and practice that when tests are viewed as important, teachers and schools focus on teaching to the test. They teach the content that's on the test, and they often use methodologies of instruction that are very similar to the test. That is, in this case, teachers will emphasize memorization, and the procedures they use will focus on sort of a rote drill, repetition, and repeating back to the teacher. Again, it's not that that is never okay. The problem comes when that is most or all of what happens in the school day. We know that for low-income kids and often kids of color in this country, that kind of rote, what we call drill and kill, is all too common. And what we fear is that President Clinton's proposal for tests, these tests will become important. Clinton clearly wants them to be viewed as important. Teachers will teach to them. And that instead of creating a classroom where students get seriously engaged in learning and where they learn both the facts and what the facts mean and how to think about the facts and how to use the information, they'll only get this sort of extremely dry and boring rote memorization curriculum. It turns off lots of kids. We already know that. It drives some kids literally out of school. It does not enable kids to attain the knowledge there and the capabilities they're going to need to be active, participatory people in a democratic society. And so rather than, you know, what's ironic is the standards that Clinton and other folks claim to want often include a lot of claims that students should learn higher-order thinking skills. They should learn to, you know, synthesize, analyze, evaluate, problem solve, create, and so on. And the rubber hits the road with standards when it comes to the test. That is, the part of the standards that's really going to count is what's on the test. So you have high standards on the one side and low-level tests on the other side. And the unfortunate part will be is that the low-level tests will thoroughly undermine the high-level standards. The end result will be that rather than being used to help improve instruction and lead to higher and richer and more serious learning, it'll actually undermine serious learning.
We're talking to Monty Neal, Associate Director of the National Center for Fair and Open Testing, known as FAIR Test. Mary Bergen also now joins us. She's president of the California Federation of Teachers, which represents 45,000 teachers and education support personnel at all levels of public education in California. She's also vice president of the American Federation of Teachers, which represents close to 1 million school personnel nationwide. And is it true, Mary, you were there yesterday with President Clinton?
Yes, I was.
Well, thank you very much for being on with us. What are your thoughts on Monty Neal's criticism of this proposal, which I know you support, for the standardized test for fourth and eighth graders to improve national education standards?
Well, I must say I just heard the tail end of it, but I think we shouldn't jump to the conclusion that that all standardized tests are by definition a low-level test. If you look at if you compare the United States with other countries, you'll see that those countries, by and large, tend to have some sort of national test that the comparison and that they are widely accepted, and that if you also look, as did the third International Math and Science Study, at other variables such as what kind of teaching goes on in the classroom, what level students are learning at, it's very clear that, in fact, students, let's say in Japan, which ranks above us in math, those students are taught for learning, for a deep understanding of their material, and that the teaching is very engaging in terms of how the students come to the understanding of the material, and then that is, in fact, reflected in their testing. So I think a lot is going to depend on this, in how we develop that test and exactly what the content of it is. It does not necessarily, just as a standardized test means it's geared to particular standards. It doesn't mean that it is necessarily all multiple choice, just fill in the blank. And if you just take the first one, you can probably get 20%, let's say.
If I may comment, it's certainly true that a standardized test does not have to be all. In fact, a standardized test could be no multiple choice. The problem is that the administration has already said it will be 80% multiple choice, and for $5 a child to administer and score, there's no reason to believe it could be anything less than 80% multiple choice. Most of the other countries that the U.S. typically wants to compare itself to do not use multiple choice. Either they don't use it at all or they don't use it very much. And virtually none of those countries actually test younger children. They used to. The European countries, West European countries, used to test kids in younger grades. Virtually all of them have stopped doing that with any kind of national test. Britain is about the only major exception, and they're not noted for their great education system. But countries like Germany and France only test at high school, and Germany actually does not have a national exam. They're state exams. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of mixed information that comes out of other countries. I certainly agree with Mary that we ought to be teaching for learning, and it was interesting that the Japanese seem to do more of that, and it seems to result in higher scores because the kids have a deeper comprehension of what's going on. What I'm suggesting is that yet one more multiple choice test, and kids in this country, for the most part, take at least one multiple choice test per year already. Giving them one more multiple choice test will do absolutely nothing to improve the quality of instruction or the learning outcomes.
Well, let's put that question again to Mary Bergen about these multiple choice tests.
Well, let me say this. What really distresses me about the conversation is that I think our emphasis, and certainly the emphasis for us in the AFT, is on the standards part of this, of the test. In other words, that we need to look at high expectations for our students, and that we need to look at asking more of our students than we are asking today, and we can, and our students can meet those expectations. And to the extent that any sort of test pushes that expectation, and quite frankly, that is what happens in this country, and probably in any country, that the test, especially if the test has some consequences to it, does in fact help us increase our expectations and help overall learning. The whether or not it is a total multiple choice, I think that's going to wait and see. And I would also suggest that it's very difficult, and I say this unhappily, to essentially get and sell, as we found out in California, some of our more sophisticated tests, which is not to say we're going to stop trying to do that. I think we need to really look at a test that measures well what we want to teach.
I wanted to go to another issue around standardized tests that has been raised for many years now by groups like FairTest, and that is the issue of racial and gender discrimination. Monty Neal, can you talk a little about that and talk about whether you think it applies to these tests, but what you mean by that?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of areas here. In a sense, technically, you might say that a test is racially or gender biased if it's if the scores typically attained by one group misrepresent what they really know. In other words, simply a gap between whites and blacks does not prove that a test is biased. It may be that because of differential schooling, which certainly occurs in this country, that blacks have had, that whites or blacks may have had an opportunity to learn more of what's tested. Typically in this country, of course, it's whites. Bias occurs that if most measures will tell you that the learning, say, is not different, but the test results favor one group over another. For example, the SAT, which is commonly taken for college admissions, shows that men outperform women on both the verbal and the math parts. It is, as far as I know, virtually the only test in which men outperform women on the verbal part. And secondly, men outperform women on the math part of that test by far more than they do on virtually any other test. The test is supposed to predict how well a student will do in their first year of college. That's its sort of scientific claim. What it actually does is it underpredicts how well women will do and overpredicts how well men will do and is therefore biased against women and biased for men. Typically, test makers now do a variety of things to try to at least minimize bias on their tests. I think there's good reason to believe that in terms of race, the tests are at least a lot less biased than they were, say, 30 years ago. I mean, you could see literally openly racist kinds of questions on tests 30 years ago. You don't see that anymore. I think there are underlying cultural biases that tend to remain in the tests. There are complicated technical reasons that lead to a reinforcement of bias on those tests. There are certainly questions about whether the multiple choice format or whether what they call speededness, that is putting a time limit on the test, may be have adverse effects on women and some minorities. It's certainly true speededness will affect people who are being tested in their second language, for example. And the speededness may or may not be relevant to what you're actually trying to measure. That is, if you're trying to measure how well someone will write in general, making them write more quickly might not be relevant to how well they can write in general. Of course, if it's writing for something where there's always a very limited time, then the time limit is relevant, but it may not be in general. So the issue of bias really has to do with how well it matches the thing you're actually trying to measure. Will the test that the Clinton administration is proposing be biased? I am sure they will do what they can to eliminate and reduce bias. I don't have a lot of doubt about that. I would be, I would say it's certainly possible that bias will remain on those tests. It becomes subtle kinds of bias become difficult to disentangle, and from the differential effects of education, we know well that poor kids in this country don't get as good an education as middle class and rich kids get. That shows up on test scores, and in a sense, it ought to show up on test scores. How to separate that from class or race or other kinds of bias, it's just really hard to know.
Mary Bergen, let me ask you this question as we wrap up. As president of the California Federation of Teachers, however people feel about the standardized tests, What do you think would be the one most important effort in this country that could improve education and education standards in the country?
Well, I think the most important effort would be to take what we learn about standards. First of all, I think the most important thing is to increase the standards and to let everyone know what they are, so they know where they're going, and then to look at them back, turn it back to how we teach and how we teach differentially, as was just indicated, in different places, so that we can intervene, get students the help they need quickly before while they can actually catch up.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us, and also give people a chance to get the phone numbers of each of your organizations. Monty Neal, the National Center for Fair and Open Testing, Fair Test. How can people get a hold of your newsletter and your reports?
We're in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Our address is 342 Broadway. The zip code is 02139. Our phone number is 617-864-4810.
And Mary Bergen, the California Federation of Teachers, if people would like to get a hold of your work, of your reports.
510-832-8812. And I should also give you the National AFT, because they really have
Great.
A lot of work, and that's done a lot of work on this. And that is 202-879-4400.
One more time, that last number.
202-879-4400.
I want to thank you both very much for joining us, Mary Bergen, President of the California Federation of Teachers, and Monty Neal, Associate Director of the National Center for Fair and Open Testing, known as Fair Test. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back to take a look at the top 10 most censored stories of 1996. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, and I'm Amy Goodman. Well, they're not stories you'll read in the New York Times or see on ABC News, but you may hear them on Democracy Now! Or read them in Covert Action Quarterly. They're the most censored news stories of 1996. Project Censored, a media watchdog group based at Sonoma State University in California, released this past week the top 10 censored news stories of 1996. Here to let us know what they are is Peter Phillips, the director of Project Censored. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Peter.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you with us, and also to have this list of the top 10 censored stories, which is actually quite a dubious distinction that someone should get, meaning that you write a story, it's published, and then no one else ever picks up on it.
Unfortunately, a lot of these stories just aren't covered in the mainstream news. They're stories about powerful making decisions in major bureaucracies, both public and private, that affect all of our lives, and mainstream press, corporate press, simply just isn't covering it.
Well, why don't we talk about just what these top 10 censored stories are, beginning with number one, risking the world nuclear proliferation in space.
Well, this number one story this year is actually about something that's going to happen in the future. It's the Cassini space probe. that's set to lift off in October from Florida. It will be fired atop a Titan IV rocket made by Lockheed Martin, and it will, to power the spacecraft, which ultimately will go to Saturn, will require 72 pounds of plutonium. Now, plutonium is the most dangerous substance known to humans. 1 pound evenly distributed, according to Helen Caldicott, would give everybody in the world lung cancer. So we're risking on takeoff that this Titan IV rocket won't blow up and display, you know, drop plutonium all over Florida. And then they're going to fire it to Venus, whip it around Venus twice, bring it back at 42,000 miles an hour towards Earth, adjust it as it's approaching Earth so it'll swing by, so theoretically, 300 miles above Earth. If it happens to hit the Earth atmosphere, it could rain plutonium particles down on the whole world. This story was actually written by Carl Grossman, a professor at SUNY University, State University in New York. He's been writing about this and talking about it for a couple of years, and the mainstream press simply isn't talking about it.
Let's go to number two, Shell's Oil, Africa's Blood.
This is a story about the Nigerian execution. Now, this was widely covered in that Nigeria executed 9 environmental activists, including Nobel Prize winner and leader of the Movement for Survival of the Ogoni People, Ken Saro-Wiwa. The executed activists were involved in massive protests against Royal Dutch Shell because of environmental devastation it had caused. The United States, home of Royal Dutch Shell's subsidiary, Shell Oil Company, located in Houston, Texas, imports about 50% of Nigeria's annual oil production. Now, according to Dr. Owen Wiwa, Ken Saro-Wiwa's brother, he's reported that on 3 occasions, Brian Anderson, the managing director of Shell Petroleum Oil Company in Nigeria, offered to make a deal with Wiwa that would try to prevent the executions if the activists would call off their protests. Wiwa refused, Shell did not intervene, and the activists were all executed. Our story number 3 for last year has to do with the big perks for the wealthy hidden in the minimum wage bill. Now, the wage bill was passed last year, signed into law, as it publicized that the minimum wage is going up from $4.25 to $5.15. What was not publicized by the mainstream media was the bill reinstated tax incentives for leveraged buyouts, put into tax reform. It created a new minimum wage bill, successfully protected multimillionaires from paying taxes on unrepatriated foreign income. The bill did away with the requirement that companies must offer the same benefits to lower-wage employees as they do to higher-wage employees, and also did away with a surtax on luxury car purchases and diesel fuel for yachts. So there were nice pieces in that legislation, not covered by the mainstream press, that went to the wealthy.
Now, this was a piece by John Judas,
right,
in the New Republic.
That was in the New Republic, right.
Very little coverage of the minimum wage bill. It was only, are we helping poorer people too much?
That's basically what the media was talking about at the time.
Well, what about Project Censored Stories number 4, Deforming Consent, the PR Industry's Secret War on Activists?
This is actually a fairly broad form of censorship that we talk about. We call public relations censorship. And this is where the PR industry, backed by major corporate clients, create phony nonprofit organizations and mobilize private detective lawyers and attempt to influence editorial and news decisions by launching these false grassroots campaigns using high-tech information systems. A recent high-profile example is the health industry created the Nonprofit Coalition for Health Insurance Choices to defeat Clinton's administration's attempt at health reform. This is back in 1993. An additional example is Hill & Knowlton, one of the largest PR firms in the country, created a front group called Partners for Sun Protection Awareness in 1994. This was supposed to educate the public on the dangers of skin cancer due to ultraviolet radiation, but it was paid for by Schurer and Prowl, makers of the Coppertone skin lotion. So this anti-public interest campaign generated false impressions of public support in the name of citizen activism. This story was in Covert Action Quarterly and was published back in 1995 and 96.
I like the term that was coined by Lloyd Benson, astroturf lobbying.
Astroturf lobbying, that's exactly what it is.
As opposed to grassroots. Well, let's move on to we're doing just a cursory look. Some of these we've actually dealt with in depth in Democracy Now! We did have Carl Grossman on, who did the first piece on nuclear proliferation in space. But Project Censored 1996, top censored story, number 5, corporate crime, whitewash at the Justice Department.
Corporate crime and white-collar crime costs America 10 to 50 times more money than street crime, and the Justice Department continues to show little interest in taking this problem seriously. Based on centralized records obtained by the Department of Justice, the data shows that when it comes to white-collar crime, the federal government almost never brings criminal charges against businesses. Of the more than 51,000 federal criminal indictments in 1994, only 250, less than one-half of 1%, involved criminal violations of the nation's environmental, occupational health and safety, or consumer product laws. However, in 1987 alone, 50 to 70,000 workers died prematurely on the job due to toxins, roughly three times the 21,000 people murdered in the same year. And since 1970, when OSHA was first formed, 20,000 Americans have died on the job. A significant number of these were due to employer negligence. But in the 22-year period, only 88 criminal cases were brought to the Justice Department. Only 25 were prosecuted, and only one business executive was actually jailed for 45 days.
I think it's quite something, just the figures that white-collar crime costs America 10 to 50 times more money than street crime. Just that fact alone is something for people to repeat.
These are fairly amazing stories.
Well, let's move on to number 6. New mega merge banking behemoths, big risk. Try to say that three times fast.
The massive consolidation of the nation's banking resources has resulted in now 71.5% of the U.S. banking interests are controlled by the 100 largest banking organizations, representing about 1% of the total banks. So the trend towards bigger banks is creating a system whereby giant banking institutions are becoming too big to fail. Indeed, a failure of any one of these could have devastating impacts on the nation's financial health. With the Federal Reserve capping the amount that financial institutions have to pay into government bank insurance funds at $25 billion, just 1.25% of deposits are now insured. Consequently, any bailout of any of these new huge banks would directly come from the pockets of taxpayers. Studies have also found there's kind of a consumer issue to this. The banks in concentrated markets tend to charge higher rates for loans and tend to offer lower interest rates on certain types of deposits than do banks in less concentrated markets. This was in the Multinational Monitor in June 1996.
You know, it's interesting. The 1995 study that was done by the U.S. Public Interest Research Group showed that fees on checking and savings account increased at twice the rate of inflation from 93 to 95 as bank mergers move forward. And we have their latest study that's all over the papers in the last few days that U.S. PIRG did on the costs of ATMs.
Yep, they're kind of, as they consolidate, their bottom line is increasing, and we're paying for it.
That's right, that when you go to the ATM, not of your bank, but to get out your money, especially the largest banks are charging a lot more money. I think the fees range from anywhere from 25 cents to $2. Well, moving on from the Multinational Monitor's censored story, we go to Cashing In on Poverty, Project Censored number 7 story. Again, this is a story by Michael Hudson that we also did on Democracy Now!, the whole issue of, how the poor are bilked.
Yeah, 60 million poor people are without bank accounts or access to competitive loans in the country, and they use pawn shops, check cashing outlets, rent to own. What we're finding now is that increasingly this $300 billion business is owned and subsidized by Wall Street giants such as American Express, Bank of America, Citibank, Ford, Nations Bank, and Western Union. Low-income people are paying as much as 240% from a loan from a pawnbroker, 300% for a finance company loan, and even up to 2,000% for a fast payday loan from a check cashing outlet. The overall number of check cashing outlets in the country has tripled to 5,500 since the 1980s, and rent-to-own stores have gone up to 7,500 in the same period. A typical loan rate of 200% can occur at Cash America's chain of pawn stores, and they've quickly grown to 325 in the United States. American Express finances ACE Cash Express, a national chain of 630 check cashing outlets. Charges average 3 to 6% for each check's value. And Cash America, the country's largest chain of pawn stores, is bankrolled by Nations Bank and traded in the New York Stock Exchange. In 1993, three-fifths of Ford's earnings came from car loans, mortgages, and consumer loans. Associate Corporations of North America is a Ford subsidiary targeting low-income, blue-collar, and minority consumers. In 1994, it financed $18.5 billion in mortgages and consumer loans and earned just under $1 billion in pre-tax profits. This was actually in The Nation by Mike Hudson and the Houston Chronicle back in 1996.
Right, and it ended up being published in a book. I thought it's interesting that he talked about the Ford Motor Corporation. We think of it in terms of automobile sales, but actually the Fortune 500 status comes from its financial services holdings.
That's exactly right.
Well, on to number eight, as we move fast and furiously, Big Brother goes high tech.
George Orwell's predictions concerning government surveillance is essentially coming true. In fact, in Britain, nearly all public areas now are monitored by over 150,000 closed-circuit television cameras, each equipped with a powerful zoom lens that a camera can read words on a cigarette package up to 100 yards. The FBI has also developed miniature TV cameras that can be put in lamps, clocks, radios, duffel bags, purses, etc., and other objects and control to pan, tilt, scoom, or focus anywhere in the public areas. Another type of new surveillance camera is developed to boost the equivalent of X-ray vision and can penetrate clothing to see concealed weapons and plastic explosives or drugs. Also, there's new biometric technologies which use sophisticated computer scanning to measure personality characteristics as fingerprints, retinal patterns, and the geometry of the hands. While technologically dazzling, such advances threaten to render public privacy vulnerable on a scale we've never known before. Another story from Covert Action Quarter. They actually had four in our top 10 this year.
And that piece was called Access, Privacy, and Power by Michael Russ and Susan Crabtree. Big Brother goes high tech. Moving on to number nine, U.S. troops exposed to depleted uranium during the Gulf War. And this was what, in the Multinational Monitor?
Multinational Monitor was one of the first places we saw it. It's actually been published in a number of magazines now, the Catholic Reporter, the VA Veteran. This is kind of an extension of the Gulf War syndrome story. You know, just a year ago, actually, the military was still saying that Gulf War syndrome was due to stress and was similar to other war veterans, and that all these veterans getting sick was just mostly in their mind. But in the last year, we found out that up to 100,000 of them may have been exposed to chemical weapons or gases in during the war. But the depleted uranium weapons were used for the first time in the war situation in the Persian Gulf in 91. And these are hailed as an incredibly new effective weapon by the Department of Defense. The use of weaponry in the Persian Gulf served two purposes. It eliminated enemy troops and disposed of tens of even thousands of tons of radioactive DU, depleted uranium, in the Persian Gulf battlefield. So these shells are hardened with depleted uranium, so they make them very, very effective. The U.S. Army fired at least 14,000 rounds, up to 40 tons of DU ammunition. And the Defense Department did circulate a memo to Gulf War commanders that contained three key points. Any vehicle or system struck by a DU penetrator could be assumed to be contaminated, and personnel should avoid entering contaminated areas. If troops ever entered contaminated areas, they should wear protective clothing. Unfortunately, this memo was written March 7th, 1991, 8 days after the firing of weapons ceased in the Persian Gulf.
Well, we're now at number 10, facing food scarcity.
The World Bank and the UN Food Organization have continued to project surplus capacity and declining prices for food. The food shortage will become even greater in the sense that the conclusions from the World Summit in 1996 said that there would be enough food that poor countries could be responsible for feeding their own people. However, the Japanese Ministry of Agriculture has recently released projections in late December of 95 that shows a doubling of world grain prices by the year 2010, and the prices for wheat and rice could go 2 to 3 times their base food of 1992. So the World Agriculture Outlook, the world stock of rice, wheat, corn, and other grains has fallen to the lowest levels in 2 decades. These projections differ sharply from that of the World Bank, which has stuck to its projections of continuously declining grain prices over the same period.
Well, you've done an amazing job, Peter Phillips, in going through these 10 top censored stories, especially because you have to give some depth to these because so few people get to actually hear about them. That from World Watch. And it shows just how we have to turn to alternative publications, I think, like the Multinational Monitor, like The Nation magazine, like the Covert Action Quarterly, like World Watch and other publications. And to, you know, also to support alternative media like Pacifica Radio and Democracy Now!, which brings you these kind of alternative stories. Now, you've put all of these stories together in a book where you have the whole articles printed. How can people get a hold of that book?
The book's available in bookstores now nationwide. It's called Censored, 1997, The News Didn't Make the News. Over 120 faculty and students at Sonoma State University participated in putting this book together. There's a 1-800 number.
Give it.
At 1-800-596-7437.
One more time.
1-800-596-7437 to order the book.
Peter Phillips, I want to thank you very much for joining us, the director of Project Censored, a media watchdog group based in Sonoma, California. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland is our engineer and assistant producer. Thanks to Kevin Cartwright at KPFA in Berkeley. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!